This is your last chance to enter the Ohio Lottery's Fun Turns 50 promotion. Score $3,500 and two tickets to the epic party at the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, where you could win part of another $400,000 in cash prizes. Enter the new 50th anniversary scratch-off or $50 worth of eligible non-winning $5 or $10 scratch-offs and My Lotto rewards through the Ohio Lottery app. Hurry up! The last entry deadline is May 13th. Lottery players are subject to Ohio laws and commission regulations. Play responsibly.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to New Books in Native American Studies, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm your host, Annabella Breck, and today we'll be talking to Natasha Varner about her new book, La Raza Cosmética, Beauty, Identity, and Settler Colonialism in Post-Revolutionary Mexico. Natasha Varner, welcome to the show.
Hi, thank you so much. I'm excited to be here.
Natasha, I wonder if you could kick things off today by telling us a bit about yourself.
Sure. Yeah. My name is Natasha Varner. I live in Seattle, Washington now. I'm originally from Flagstaff, Arizona, and spent most of my life there. I currently work at an organization called Densho, which is focused on Japanese American history. And I really love doing that because it bridges my interest in history with social justice, and we do a lot of work around immigrant rights. The organization is focused on documenting the history of Japanese American incarceration through oral histories and other archives, but do a lot to draw parallels between that historical injustice and things that are happening now. So that's really important work to me. And of course, this book that we're here to talk about has been a project that's been near and dear to my heart for the past decade or so. So it's exciting to see it out in the world, and I'm really looking forward to getting to talk to you more about it.
Wonderful. And how did you come to write La Raza Cosmética?
So this project came about when I was kind of debating whether or not I wanted to continue in academia. I had just finished a master's degree in Latin American studies, and I was working for a project called First Peoples, New Directions in Indigenous Studies, which was a Mellon-funded project to produce books by first-time authors in the field of Indigenous studies. So I was the program coordinator for that. And, you know, I was kind of thinking a lot about Mexican history still after coming out of my master's program, thinking I didn't want to do academia anymore. But as I was getting more and more engaged in the field of Indigenous studies and going to a lot of conferences, and you know, this was right about the time that NYSA was emerging as a professional organization. I was going to those conferences and getting engaged in that field. And, you know, it just really struck me that a lot of the conversations that were happening in that field applied to patterns I'd seen in Mexican history, you know, specifically around nationalism and national identity in the post-revolutionary era. And so I just had this realization that, you know, I actually have something to say that's not being said yet about Mexican history through this lens of Indigenous studies and settler colonialism. I was also taking classes at that time, kind of, again, toying with the idea of pursuing a PhD, but not sure if I was going to do that. But in one of those classes, I focused a semester research project on the Miss Universe pageant, which Miss Mexico won that year. And it just like crystallized for me that a lot of these discourses and patterns were still very much relevant today. And so once I had that realization and, you know, saw that they were playing out in beauty pageants in, you know, really interesting and bizarre and campy ways, I realized I had a project I really wanted to pursue. So went ahead and, you know, applied and went through the PhD program and knew all along I really wanted this to be a book in the end. So even as I was writing the dissertation, made really deliberate choices, in terms of not putting some things in the dissertation and kind of a long-term plan for what this project would look like as a book. So that's the long answer. But yeah, this is 10 years in the making. So it's exciting to be at this stage where it's out in the world, exciting and kind of terrifying, but happy to be at this point.
I'm excited that it's out in the world too. It's great. So immediately following the Mexican Revolution, cultural elites idealized and pursued a Mexican future defined by mestizaje and modernity. Both of these futures in their minds hinged upon the gradual integration and erasure of indigenous peoples, especially women. In the immediate post-war years, these settler colonial currents manifest themselves in the India Bonita pageant. Can you tell us a little bit more about the purpose behind the pageant and how it came to narrowly redefine and idealize the quote-unquote authentic indigenous woman?
Yeah, so this pageant that I talk about in chapter one of the book was launched by a daily newspaper, El Universal, in 1921. And the stated mission of the pageant when they announced it was to find the prettiest Indian in all of Mexico. And the way that played out over the next several months, it became a serialized pageant. And so every day or every couple days, you'd get a different portrait and a little write-up about contestants appearing in the newspaper. Looking through this archive of the pageant was really interesting, because what you see is this vast diversity of indigenous women's lives in the years immediately following the revolution. And you know, this is really remarkable in and of itself, because there aren't that many there isn't much in the archives that shows what indigenous women in, you know, urban spaces were doing in this particular moment in history. It's hard to find those. So it's a pretty incredible archive just for that reason alone. But despite the fact that it shows, you know, this great diversity of how indigenous women were making their way through the world, you know, as Mexico was trying to rebuild after the revolution, the overarching theme of the pageant is tends to prioritize a certain type of indigenous woman that fit into stereotypes about what traditional and submissive indigenous women look like. And so even though you see this great diversity of women throughout the course of the pageant, what you see at the very end is, a handful of contestants who have very similar, hairstyles and dress styles. And so it really privileges a very specific and kind of fixed notion of what it means to be an indigenous woman. And so that's why I argue that the pageant, you know, even though it was aiming to kind of represent indigenous women and honor them, what it ultimately did was use this really narrow lens that was wrapped up in ideas about what authentic indigeneity looked like. And this was informed by, you know, anthropologists who were involved in this project as panel judges, specifically Manuel Gamio. You know, so it really narrowed what the public saw as being an authentic Indigenous woman. And so ultimately, I argue this was a project of erasure, even though that erasure came about through representation that was otherwise pretty unprecedented. So it really just kind of highlights the fact that throughout this whole history that I look at, there were just so many paradoxes like that, where there was like hypervisibility, but also that hypervisibility ultimately lent itself to this bigger project of erasure and kind of fixing indigeneity in the past so that idealized mestizaje or the, idealized mixing of the races could be presented as the future of Mexico.
Yeah, as you point out, India Bonita wasn't the only pageant that idealized and objectified Indigenous women. Of the same vein was the Flor Mas Bahia de Ejido, which originated in Santa Anita. And while the pageant paradoxically sought to, you know, supposedly honor Indigenous women and their communities, it also coincided with urbanization efforts that only selectively incorporated the region's Indigenous characteristics into an urban future that was ultimately absence of Indigenous presence. What different forms did the pageant take during the 1920s and 1930s? And how did it contribute to projects of defining and discarding Indigenous identities?
Yeah, so this pageant is really an interesting one. I found out about it because it often would get conflated with the India Bonita pageant. And so people would reference it when I was talking about the India Bonita pageant, but it took me a minute to understand what was happening because the India Bonita pageant only happened 1 year and they would be talking about, oh yeah, the India Bonita pageant from 1929. It's like, it wasn't an India Bonita pageant in 1929. So anyway, I started digging and found out about this pageant, which actually predated colonization of Mexico. It's an ancient spring flower maiden tradition that survived and kind of became like a syncretic practice combined with Catholicism over the centuries. And then it had mostly died out, not been, a major part of the community's life by the time of the revolution, but it was still practiced. It had been somewhat co-opted by the elites and non-Indigenous folks, but it was kind of a dying tradition in some ways. But in 1923, when people who were invested in this project of nation building were looking for different ways to engage the public and kind of perform national identity in different ways, seized upon this pageant as an opportunity to accomplish some of the same things that the India Bonita pageant did in terms of, doing a cursory celebration of indigeneity, but ultimately kind of marginalizing and setting indigeneity apart from what they saw as the kind of march to the future. And so the pageant 1923 was reinvented and became a celebration that was held annually. And again, for in many of the years, it evolved from year to year. It wasn't a static thing at all. But in many of the celebrations over the next several decades, there would be some kind of competition for Indigenous dress or performance of indigeneity. In some cases, it was around food or culinary arts. In some cases, it was around costume or the way a station was kind of decorated. So it evolved a lot, and it ended up really reflecting the way that the city was expanding and growing in the sense that as Santa Anita got more and more urbanized, beginning in the late 30s and into the 40s, this area of the city that had been conceptualized as being a locus for tradition and kind of, it had previously been more on the outskirts of Mexico City and had a big waterway that ran through the neighborhood. And so it was conceptualized as being representative of Mexico Viejo, or old Mexico. But as it became kind of swallowed up by this urban expansion and other public health needs took precedence, the whole community was transformed and became less of this idealized place for old Mexico. And in that process, it also became a less ideal site for the practice of tradition, or things that were conceptualized as being traditional. And so the pageant itself ended up getting moved to Xochimilco, which I think we'll talk about more later. It was another area that was conceptualized as being, you know, a spot where old Mexico was very visible. But the community that, you know, where this pageant and this springtime festival had been in existence in various forms for centuries, kind of lost their ability to make claim to it as they urbanized. And so it just, the whole pageant kind of shows this double bind that indigenous peoples found themselves in this time period, in the sense that there was a lot of, you know, there was a benefit to the strategic performance of this idealized trope of indigeneity, but then once that trope no longer worked from kind of a larger city planning view, it could be used as a way to dispossess indigenous peoples of their right to those traditions. I don't know if I'm totally explaining that well. It's a complex thing, but it was like the more they performed the traditional role, the more it meant that once the space they were performing that in was no longer deemed traditional, it kind of underscored and helped justify this logic of dispossession from people that were transforming the community and in charge of kind of running the city and making these decisions.
Yeah, for people who have read Phil DeLoria or maybe Jean O'Brien's work, that's a very familiar idea that you share in your book. Mm-hmm.
I just wanted to take the moment to say that, you know, both Jean O'Brien and Philip DeLoria were major influences, and just really value their work a lot. I talk about this in the introduction, but yeah, thanks for mentioning them.
Yeah, of course. In chapter 3, you turn to films that, though diverse in genre and content, all exploited indigenous women's bodies for the purpose of projecting this quote-unquote idealized mestizo future. I'm wondering if you can tell us a bit about those films, why you chose to focus on the ones you did, and what they tell us about their audiences.
Yeah, so I tried to find films that took indigenous women's beauty as, it wasn't just like incidental to the film, but kind of a plot point or focused on specifically in some way. There was one film that was actually a retelling of the India Bonita pageant that I talk a lot about, that was produced in 1938. And I tried to pick films from a variety of genres to show how this trope of the India Bonita, which, you know, is not, when I use that term, it's not referring to actual indigenous women. It's referring to this invention of a stereotype, essentially, of indigeneity and idealized female indigeneity. But in this chapter about film, I try to show how that idea moved from the realm of beauty pageants and kind of in-person performances onto the silver screen. And this is another point that I try to make in the book, is that, you know, all this discourse about national identity was coinciding with this huge explosion in technologies that allowed for the reproduction of images. So whether that was print or film, it really bolstered and amplified these discourses. And so that's one of the reasons why it felt really important to focus on film in this way. And yeah, you know, it was challenging to select just a handful of films. I definitely have a lot of pages of discussion about films that I ultimately cut from the chapter. I didn't want to, you know, belabor the point too much, but I tried to pick the most representative films from a variety of genres. I think the most challenging one that I worked with was this pornographic film that I found in the archives when I was doing my dissertation research. And, you know, right when I started this project, I knew that in addition to looking at beauty pageants, I would be really interested in seeing the other ways that ideals of female indigeneity were manifested in popular culture. So I was really curious about how that might have been trafficked on the black market. And so I was searching for stuff like this. You know, I thought maybe I would get some like pinup photos or something of like mestiza women dressed as indigenous women. That's what I was anticipating. But I ended up finding this film, and it was really, it's one of the worst pieces of popular culture I've ever had to look at. And when I first saw it, it was too much for me to really grapple with it and include it in the dissertation, because it's just really so dark and violent. But I knew that I needed to include it in the book because it's significant for a number of reasons. First of all, it's you know, a rare, very rare film from the 1920s or 30s, a silent film produced in Mexico. And it's the only film that I've found from that era that features as its lead a woman with visibly indigenous characteristics. And so, you know, it felt like a very important piece of popular culture to include and write about. And especially the fact that, you know, just really underscores this pattern of sexual violence that Indigenous women have been subjected to in these processes of colonialism, and just kind of lays it out there in a really crass way. So that was a really challenging piece to include, but it felt very important. And I tried to do it with care. And, you know, I think it does tell us, you know, a lot about the audiences. I think there's, you know, very little known or written about how these kinds of films would have been consumed. But looking at the film and the way that men are positioned within the film, what it indicated to me was that, you know, this film was made for an audience of more elite, probably mestizo men, probably urban men who were, I think I call it sexual slumming in the book, you know, just kind of imagining themselves into these spaces that were otherwise taboo, or, you know, you wouldn't like openly talk about this, but that really replicate this pattern of sexual violence. So yeah. And beyond that, you know, it's kind of hard to, in general, know what films say about audiences. So I focus a lot of the analysis on the films themselves and try to do a combination of, you know, close readings of the films as text, but also framing them within this historical context in which they were produced. Yeah, I think that answers your question, but let me know if I missed anything.
Yeah, no, that's wonderful. And I do think that you know, your treatment of those films, when I was reading your description, I shared the same sentiment of like, oh my gosh, I can't believe that this, the La Campesina film is real. but yeah. You treat it with such care. And I think that you show, you know, that those are important mediums to explore in this very wide-ranging project of, you know, these different ways that Indigenous women are portrayed and how they're supposed to be consumed and understood. As you mentioned earlier, and you explain at length in the book, Mexican modernization initiatives often affixed indigenous peoples to distant rural landscapes in order to convey a form of so-called authenticity and deny them of their modernity. That process also comes to play itself out just south of Mexico City in the historically indigenous community of Xochimilco, where an idyllic and storied landscape, and especially indigenous women who actually resided there, became marketing props for international and urban tourism. What did Xochimilco come to represent in the 1940s, and how did indigenous peoples living there respond to changes that directly impacted the region?
So Xochimilco is a really interesting space. It's been long conceptualized as this site of of old Mexico, you know, as the city grew and urbanized, and it was a destination for city dwellers to kind of go and recreate, and it's really defined by this major system of waterways that you can kind of take boats through and have a leisurely escape from the stresses of city life. So it's long held this role as being kind of an escape to old Mexico. And in the period I look at, after the revolution, it was undergoing this major, a lot of major changes. You know, it had been impacted by the revolution itself, and then urbanization, demand for water in Mexico City, and then also major deforestation were causing huge environmental changes to Xochimilco. And there was a lot of panic about, you know, the loss or the potential loss of this really important site. I look at a lot of different like people writing kind of mournful odes to Xochimilco and the potential loss and how it's this treasure of Mexico. But at the same time, you know, just all these competing forces introducing a lot of change and a lot of threats to the space. Some of that changed as Mexico developed its tourism industry. So beginning in the late 1920s, but really into the 1930s and 40s, as the tourism industry took off and became more lucrative, Xochimilco became even more important as a destination for tourists, both from within Mexico and international tourists. And so you see this kind of tension between what's actually happening on the ground in terms of this space really changing and what tourism magnates were trying to portray it as in terms of being this site of tradition and, you know, these pristine waterways where you could go and have a relaxing getaway. And so you see this tension, and this is where the trope of the India Bonita ended up being really critical. Tourism campaigns ended up really centering indigenous women as being this symbol of purity and tradition. And so you see more and more advertising campaigns and other tourism materials that center indigenous women in order to kind of like distract from the fact that this was really an evolving community, this, you know, hyper focus on traditional looking indigenous women. One thing that's really interesting, I think, you know, on the ground, there were a variety of responses in terms of how indigenous women and all the people that were native to Xochimilco were responding to this. You know, some strategically engaged with these processes and, you know, found ways to work with the tourism economy. I think, you know, I think I talk about Xochimilco in almost every chapter. In the chapter about the India Bonita pageant, it's really interesting because early on in the pageant, the newspaper sends a team of reporters out there to find traditional Indigenous women. And there's a story about how, you know, they got chased off with a stick. You know, like, this woman did not want to participate in their pageant. And, you know, so you see some instances of, just non-compliance in this project. And so there's a huge range. But one thing that I found that was interesting was that there were instances where the locals were adopting the language of tourism and kind of the way the place had been romanticized in the tourist literature. They were adopting that language as an argument for preservation of the canals and waterways and of the environment there in general, through letter writing campaigns. And so it shows, you know, just a strategic engagement with these national dialogues. It shows that people who were living there were very aware of how they were being presented in tourism literature and other writings and media, and a really inventive way of reclaiming some of that language and using it to their benefit.
Yeah, and the Indigenous communities in Xochimilco obviously aren't the only Indigenous peoples doing that at this point in time. You end with this deep read of this woman named Luz Jimenez, who lived a somewhat paradoxical life and held a kind of paradoxical image. You know, she's frequently referred to as the most painted woman in all of Mexico. What can Jimenez's successes and struggles at mid-century tell us about the ways that Indigenous women navigated the logics of elimination and resisted efforts that sought to objectify and erase their identities, disempower their communities, and dispossess them of their histories?
Yeah, so Luz Jimenez's story is a really remarkable one. I feel, just a lot of tenderness for this chapter, because I was able to work with her grandson and read a lot of her letters that she wrote. And I spent, this chapter wasn't included in the dissertation, but I've spent, you know, the years since I finished the PhD program thinking about her life and writing about it. And it was really hard to strike the right tone, because on the one hand, she's this just incredible woman, incredibly talented, you know, native Nahuatl speaker, who also had a gift for teaching Nahuatl language, and was an artist, a storyteller, and was just really gifted in her ability to navigate this post-revolutionary world. You know, she got hired as a model and used that position as a way to educate artists as well. And so in that way, she became a really important teacher and component of this milieu of post-revolutionary artists, including Diego Rivera and really the most visible artist in Mexico at that time. But yeah, it also shows the double bind that Indigenous people could find themselves in at that time, because even though she was present and contributing to and shaping how indigeneity and how Indigenous women were portrayed, many of the artists were limited in how they didn't present her in any of her complexity in their portrayals of her. And, you know, despite the fact that her image was so widely reproduced across Mexico City and beyond, I haven't found records of what her compensation rate was, but whatever it was, she was still living in a situation where there were times where she was grappling with extreme poverty. And, you know, she was able to access support through some of the artists, specifically Jean Charlot, who she had a long-term friendship with. But, you know, the fact that people like Charlot and Rivera, you know, got the level of acclaim and visibility that they did. And, you know, I don't, several of the people in this group of artists weren't extremely well off themselves, at least during this period. But the fact that she was adjacent to that level of visibility and success, and yet, you know, having to continue to work as a street vendor and a domestic servant, and really struggling. You see in the letters how much she struggled just with, you know, basic medical expenses for herself and her family. And, you know, she suffered a lot because of lack of access, and, you know, developed these deep friendships where she was able to get some support from them, but it was more like a kind of charity. And you could tell in her letters that she, you know, it weighed on her to have to ask, where, you know, if she had just been like fairly compensated for her work, she wouldn't have been in the position to have to, you know, go around asking for funds to help deal with the medical crisis for herself or her mother, you know, things that came up throughout her life. So it's a really complex story. And yeah, it shows the limits of, you know, engaging with a project like this. She, you know, was extremely gifted and adapted herself to the social situation she found herself in. And I think was about as successful as anybody could be in that scenario. But, you know, ultimately the view that you see of her in all these paintings, and in the kind of representations of her that still exist, still end up showing her as more of this kind of trope of idealized indigenous womanhood than in any of the vast complexity that her life actually represented.
Well, Natasha, we've taken up a lot of your time today, but before we wrap up, I have one last question for you. What are you working on now?
Yeah. So I love Mexican history. I don't know that I'll do another book on that topic. I feel like now it's more important for me to do more kind of self-reflexive and closer to home research and inquiry. So, you know, my family is predominantly Irish American. We're from Arizona. We've been there since the 50s. And I'm really interested in the history of how the Southwest was settled by health seekers. Both sides of my family ended up in Arizona because they had children that had asthma, and doctors on the East Coast told them, you know, if you don't go to Arizona, or you don't go to drier climate, you know, your kids are going to continue to really suffer, potentially die. And this is part of this long history of people with like lung health issues and disease, tuberculosis, asthma, being sent to the Southwest. And so I'm really interested in looking at a history of health seekers, charlatans, and the settlement of the American Southwest through this process, beginning probably in the mid 1800s up until the, I don't know, I kind of want to bring it up until the, to the present. There's all these like weird health spas and that kind of stuff. So I'm trying to grapple with the scope of it, but I'm thinking that's where my research will go next. I'm also really interested in doing more writing about Irish American history in general and Irish American complicity in the projects of settler colonialism and anti-Blackness. So that's something that I don't know if that'll be a book or if I'll just continue writing shorter articles on that topic, but that's what feels like an important topic of inquiry for me right now.
Well, Natasha, those both sound like great, important topics. I want to thank you for being on the show today. I really enjoyed it. Take care.
Thank you.